is in the prison system in this country. Two people have died. Two prisoners have died in Belmarsh prison where Julian Assange is. And so he finds it difficult. In fact, we'll find it impossible on Monday even to go to the video room safely in order to participate in his own procedural hearing. So his lawyers will be arguing that the whole trial should be delayed. But today we're talking about a wider context than the immediate trial of Julian Assange, important though that is. We're talking about the context of whistleblowing and how what whistleblowers have got to say gets into the press and becomes public knowledge. And we have a panel here that really couldn't be better and couldn't be stronger. John Kiriakou was 14 years in the Central Intelligence Agency and the first serving or former officer to reveal the use of torture by the CIA. Catherine Gunn, who worked at GCHQ and revealed operations against the United Nations at the time of the Iraq War. Her exploits were immortalized in the film Official Secrets last year. And if you haven't seen that film, I very much recommend that you do so. And we're also joined last, but by no means least, by Daniel Ellsberg, who in the Pentagon Papers exposed the truth about the Vietnam War. Welcome to you all. Thank you very much for your time in this discussion. So, as I say, what I'd like to have a look at today is the way in which whistleblowing happens, about why it's important, and then crucially about the role of the press and publishers in making sure that what whistleblowers have to say gets as far as the public ear, becomes part of public political discourse. So first of all, Catherine, let me come to you. Some time has passed, and as I say, you know, you worked on, I know, the film as well, explaining what happened and why it happened. Looking back now, I thought it might be a moment to ask you, how important did you think it was? Did it turn out to be as important as you thought when you made that incredibly brave stand? Just give us your view now that you've had the time for some historical distance.
Are you referring to how important I now think it was to do the leak?
Yes.
I still have no regrets about it. Because, you know, nobody knows what their actions will result in. And the truth of the matter is, if things had been done differently, possibly at the time, if the Observer had decided to maybe work in partnership with other news organizations on the leak, which Martin Bright himself has mentioned, it was not the culture at the time. But, you know, nowadays, these things do happen and newspapers do work together on the same story to bring it to a wider audience. If that had happened, then maybe it would have had a bigger effect. And the other thing is, if MPs at the time, you know, who had personally felt strongly about the issues surrounding the Iraq War, if they had taken that, the front page of that newspaper, the actual report itself, in the newspaper and took it to, you know, Tony Blair or anybody else within the cabinet office and said, look, what is going on? Then maybe something would have changed, you know, but so who knows that why that didn't happen. That is one of the things that I'm most curious about now is why none of those things, why those things didn't happen.
And do you think, I mean, obviously a huge part of the whole political debate at the time and even more, I guess, since, was the sort of huge lie of weapons of mass destruction. But it's always seemed to me that what you did contributed to a justified public mood of scepticism about what they were being told. So it's obviously hard to isolate, you know, an individual strand within that. But it's always seemed to me that what you did contributed to that public skepticism.
Well, yeah, I don't know, because it was so close to the actual invasion, right? So I think, you know, when that email came out, when I leaked it, I leaked it right at the beginning of February. and it didn't come out until, I think, the 2nd of March. And so it was quite late in the whole process, which had been building up to that moment. But I had become skeptical a long way before that, from having read books and other articles, books specifically by Norman Solomon, Milan Rai, that came out, that were literally rushed into print, I believe, at the last minute. And I happened to find them in the bookshelves in Waterstones. So that added, obviously, to my increased skepticism about it.
Mm. Okay, John, let me turn to you. It's an issue which I hope that you can also explore, because I think it's critical, I think, that a wider audience senses what it is that gets people who are in a very difficult situation, where it requires a complete kind of breach with the kind of consensus environment around them. Obviously, a risk of prosecution, ultimately of jail. Looking back on what you did now, just tell us a bit about why you made that decision and how important it is now that you've got a bit of space to look back on it.
Yeah, wow. Good question. No, that's okay. Like Catherine, I don't at all regret what I did. I'm glad that I did it. The price has been very high. I continue to pay a price. I was involved in a court hearing just in January in which the judge called me an unrepentant criminal. But, you know, you just learn to live with things like that. To tell you the truth, when I made my revelation about the CIA's torture program, I really didn't think it was that big of a deal. The FBI later called it the worst kept secret in Washington. Amnesty International had already published a report saying that the CIA was torturing its prisoners. Human Rights Watch did the same thing. The International Committee of the Red Cross had done the same thing. I was the first person to confirm it, but I certainly didn't think I was offering anything that was necessarily new. I didn't think I had done anything particularly brave in any way. I was disappointed at the way the entire weight of the U.S. government fell on my head, certainly. But in the end, it was worth it. I sort of had to be told that it was important. Later on, John McCain said that the revelation was important because otherwise the American people really would not have known definitively that the government was torturing people in the name of the American people. And so it was worth it. And I would say also, John, that I think it's actually harder now for people to go public with these kinds of revelations than it was in 2007 when I did it, because the government, at least here in the United States, has been so much more proactive in either punishing people or in stopping them before the revelations are made. Just under the Trump administration, for example, punishments for whistleblowers are far worse than they were under Barack Obama. And I thought Obama was so bad that it couldn't get any worse. So, yeah, I think that it's tougher now to make these kinds of revelations. That's why we need WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks, I don't have to tell you, of course, but I'll tell our viewers. WikiLeaks has never had to retract a story. They've never had to issue corrections. They use first-person documents, original documents, to prove their stories. So that's why we need organizations like WikiLeaks, because it's so hard for individuals to do this on their own with the media or through the media.
Okay, John, thanks very much for that. And and just to tell viewers, people looking in on this discussion, you can, of course, ask questions. If you go down to the bar at the bottom of the screen there, you'll see that there's a Q&A function. Please do feel free to click on that and to type in your questions, or if you're watching on other media, please use the comments section and we'll try and get as many of those issues in front of our guests and to get their views on them as we go through the program here. But before we do that, I want to call on our final panelist. That's Daniel Ellsberg. Daniel, welcome to the program. Great to see you here. Of course, your leaking of the Pentagon Papers, the so-called Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War, has become a kind of landmark in the history of whistleblowing. I guess you've had a lot of time to think back on what you did and why you did it and how important you think it is. So give us your view on that.
You know, I just realized what a pleasure it is to be on this panel with two friends and heroes of mine. And I was thinking about the similarities and differences between us. Of the three, almost miraculously, John is the one who went to prison, keeping in mind that no one went to prison for the clearly criminal, under international law, human rights law, and domestic law, crime of torture. No one was even prosecuted for that, I believe. And the one person associated with that program was associated because he rang the bell on it, because he revealed that torture was going on. So that shows the concern of the government, really, and the success of the government in trying to dampen out this possibility that their criminal secrets will be told. Now, listening to Catherine, I remembered she mentioned the dates on which she put it out and when it came out. That month was crucial. Catherine is the one whistleblower known to me, and I've met a lot of them, and I've studied a lot more. I want to meet them because I admire virtually all of them that I've met, and I feel an empathy with them, an identification, and I want to give them any help or advice I can possibly do. She's the only whistleblower I have heard of who acted fast and as the situation required before the war. You were asking me, in contrast here, what effect my leaks in 1971 actually had. Well, the long answer would be none at first on the war. Big effect on public opinion, where it was known, but people were already against the war. Nixon wasn't paying any attention to that. The war got larger the next year with the offensive of 1972. The bombing I was trying to stop was the heaviest in human history in the Christmas season of 1972. So I had to tell people at that time when they asked me what effect have the Pentagon Papers had, that was a year and a half earlier. And I had to say, none, no effect. The whole anti-war movement has had no effect. Here we are. It's like the effect of the Soviet people, let's say, on the invasion of Hungary or Czechoslovakia or Afghanistan later. No say in this country. Now, that turned out not to be true for reasons that just could not have been foreseen at that point, certainly were unknown to me. Nixon had reason to fear that I had other information on him. The Pentagon Papers ended in 68 before he came into power. And they incriminated the Democrats mainly, as Henry Kissinger pointed out to Nixon. He said, actually, they make the Democrats. This is actually rather good for us. You know, they put the war on the side of the Democrats. And but Nixon had reason to fear that I had documents on his plans and threats to use nuclear weapons against North Vietnam and to do things like the mining of Haiphong, the invasion of Laos and Cambodia, which he actually did later. So in order to keep me from doing that, he committed crimes against me to stop me while I was on trial. One effort to incapacitate me totally, other efforts to listen to me and overhear a burglary of my former psychoanalyst office to get information to blackmail me with. And amazingly, and fortuitously, really, a lot of that came out by people doing things they weren't expected to do, truth-telling they weren't expected to do, like John Dean in the White House, like Alexander Butterfield, who revealed the taping, which proved what Dean had been saying, which the president denied about his criminal activities of obstruction of justice. And now we get back to the difference that Catherine made with a current contemporary document, and very extraordinarily, a single page that actually was quite incriminating, an amazing page. There was no page like that in the 7,000 pages of the Pentagon Papers. There was no page I could have put out and say, look, this shows that criminal means are being used for a criminal purpose. And so seeing that and acting extraordinarily fast on that within 48 hours, as I understand it, or maybe even sooner, she really had a chance of stopping that war that neither John or I had succeeded in doing. And after all, Blair had said, and I believe Blair had said, correct me if I'm wrong, Catherine, that he would not go to war without a second resolution from the Security Council, which Catherine prevented by showing countries like Mexico and Chile, who had been subject to CIA intervention, that the NSA and CIA were at it again, made it impossible for them to vote along with the US, and prevented that second resolution. Now, had people like Claire Short in the cabinet, who had said she would not go along without a second resolution, had she carried that out? Had Robin Cook, who did resign, been more forthright about how criminal and illegal this all was? That could have made a difference. But in particular, if the Observer or others had taken that story much earlier, it could not, I think, have been successfully censored in the U.S. the way it actually was. It was blacked out in the U.S., those front page news everywhere else. And I think things might have been different. It was not her fault. She put it in, and it took weeks and weeks from to check it out and to try other things and so forth. And that was very regrettable. In my case, I had had the documents that I put out about the Johnson administration lying us into war unconstitutionally back in 64 when I was in the Pentagon. Looking back, you ask what I regret? Certainly not, of course, putting the Pentagon Papers out finally. But that was took me 5 years to do it to the Senate. They held back unconscionably, really, for fear of the political effects on them. It took me a year and a half to give it to the, almost a year and a half, to give it to the Times and put it out, which I should have done much earlier. But no regrets there. But where I have intense regret is that as a government official, like John and Catherine, as I was back in 64, had I put out what was in my safe then, which later came out in the Pentagon Papers, before the war, and at a time when the Senate was controlled by Democrats who were against the war, very few people realize this at the time, they had a veto-proof majority there. They were against the war. They had to be lied to. I could have told them that they were being lied to, and I could have given them the documents at that time, which referred to Johnson directly. And I think he would have won the election anyway against Goldwater, who was calling openly for an expansion of the war and lost in a landslide, largely for that reason. And I knew that Johnson was going to carry out much the same policy. Well, people wouldn't have turned to Goldwater because he was proposing the same thing. There would have been no landslide, but that's not important. There would have been no war. I do not believe that had I put out what I could have put out in 64 and early 65, Johnson could have gone to war and millions of Vietnamese lives would have been saved, 58,000 American. So that's a heavy responsibility. I can only say to myself that having no precedent to look at, the thought of doing that just simply never entered my head at the time. If I had and turned back from it, I'd feel even very much worse, horribly. Than I do now. But finally, we now have a situation where, for example, just go to yesterday's news and the day before that, we have a president calling for people, and he now says sarcastically, that's absurd if you look at it, to inject themselves with disinfectant, actually acting like Jim Jones in Guyana with his cyanide-laced Kool-Aid. People standing on that stage with him, my son was asking me, how can Fauci, how can Birx stand there and not grab the microphone away and say, this is madness, and people will die as a result. Well, we'll see. We now know that scores of people in the government, in the intelligence agencies, had predicted from the Chinese experience, the beginning of it, a major pandemic, major economic consequences, as well as major loss of life. To my knowledge, not one of them spoke to the public or to Congress.
Let me stop you there, Daniel, because we will come back to that, because one of the questions that's coming up is asking exactly that issue that you're addressing. But before we do that, the second important issue that I wanted to put to all of you has already actually been asked by Mieke Buttner, who's looking in from Berlin, who was saying, who supports you? Who offers publicity for whatever might happen to a whistleblower? And Catherine, let me come back to you, because obviously, you know, those of us who haven't done this, most of us haven't done this, if we try to put ourselves in your shoes, I guess the second most important question, after you've answered the question, shall I or shan't I do this, the kind of second most important question is, how am I going to publicize what I know? Who is going to tell people? So my question is this: the relationship between the whistleblower and publishers, the media, and so forth, how are you looking at that, and what do you think about that?
Well, at the time, I was completely innocent about how things worked. You know, I was extremely naive. And I think, well, WikiLeaks didn't exist at that point. So really, I was kind of, I didn't know any journalists. Obviously, at GCHQ and in most intelligence circles, unless you're role is to cultivate journalists, you're told to stay as far away from them as possible because they're going to try and winkle out any information from you. So I knew no journalists personally, and I didn't trust them. I mean, I had to an extent internalize that sort of training. All I knew was that a contact of mine, someone I was friendly with, knew Yvonne Ridley or had met Yvonne Ridley. And that's, you know, that was the only kind of out I had. And that's what I did without too much planning or forethought. Nowadays, of course, it's a completely different scenario. And there's a lot of, I think not only is it more difficult in some respects because it's very traceable if you do things online, and even photocopying, you know, people don't realize, but photocopying contains data that can be traced to the actual printer and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, there's all manner of ways of being discovered, which basically it makes it extremely difficult for anybody who wants to do it anonymously. It's virtually impossible.
That's an interesting point, because I think most people assume that the kind of proliferation of social media and so forth necessarily makes it easier. It's interesting that you think it makes it more traceable and therefore more difficult to be the whistleblower, at least, if not to spread the information that a whistleblower brings.
Well, I mean, I'm by no means an expert, and I'm not certainly not an IT expert by any means, but I have read a book by somebody who is, and you know, basically his recommendation, if you want to do this thing, is that you have to plan in advance. You have to buy burner phones and do it with cash, and download encrypted versions of software, and only use that phone once, and then not use it again in order to contact a journalist. You know, there's a lot to consider before you do it. So I think the question is, how do we protect whistleblowers? Because they are 99.9% of the time going to be identified. And that's where I think we need to focus our attentions, is changing the law and building up networks to protect whistleblowers so there's no backlash. against them, or it minimizes the backlash against them.
Mm. John, I mean, obviously, you did end up in prison because of that. Your letters from there became famous, indeed. So your insight into this is important. Did you think that if there were sufficient publicity around what you said, that would protect you, and it didn't, or what did you feel about the issue of how what you had to say was going to get as far into the public domain as it could do?
I didn't think that I was breaking the law. And indeed, the FBI during the Bush administration concluded that I hadn't broken the law. They closed the case against me in December of 2008 after investigating me for a full year. It was only after Barack Obama became president and John Brennan became the Deputy National Security Advisor that Brennan asked the Justice Department to secretly reopen the case against me. I had no idea that I was under investigation for another 3 years. My phones were tapped. I was being followed. My emails were being intercepted. And I was finally charged with 5 felonies, including 3 counts of espionage. But I did think that the publicity would serve to protect me. It didn't. And the reason that it didn't is something that I hadn't anticipated. And that was all major media outlets taking a political position on what I had said. It was odd to me, too, because I made my revelations during the Bush administration. And so it was the right-wing media that attacked me and the left-wing media that supported me. That flipped when Barack Obama became president. And so I had the likes of MSNBC, especially Rachel Maddow, who's supposed to be so progressive, referring to me as John Kiriakou, who styles himself a whistleblower. And then my strongest support coming from Fox News and Tucker Carlson. It's like I live in bizarro world where everything is upside down and it's the opposite of what it's supposed to be. So the politicization of my revelation surprised me. And it's because in so many years at the CIA, it was drilled into my head that we couldn't be political. We had to make our analytic judgments based on the evidence. And to me, the evidence was the CIA was torturing its prisoners. Torture was official U.S. government policy. Torture was illegal, both by U.S. law and by international law. And the issue was very simple, really. It was quite simple at the end of the day. Well, the media didn't see it as simple. I'd like to reiterate something that Catherine said. It's virtually impossible to remain anonymous in this electronic age that we live in. And if someone is considering becoming a whistleblower, especially on a national security issue, he or she has to identify a trusted journalist. He or she has to have a working knowledge and understanding of encryption, end-to-end encryption, in order to protect himself, or, and this is something I recommend regularly, routinely, go to WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks has consistently protected its sources.
Mm. Daniel, let me come to you. I'd be interested to know your view of how what you had to say made it into the press and how you think that worked or didn't. But also, I've got a specific question here that James Fox has asked, and it's an interesting one. He says, Daniel, do you think it would ever be possible to have a statutory WikiLeaks, a type of safe depository for whistleblowers, a public, recognised, peopled by trusted officials, protected by law from government intrusion? Now, John's made the point that WikiLeaks, as it exists, as provides a level of protection that perhaps wasn't there before it was created. Is it conceivable that kind of work might ever be something which would be legally enforced, legally protected, I suppose?
Well, very simply, it is unconstitutional, though the Supreme Court has never ruled on the issue. But I would say very good legal opinion is it should be regarded as unconstitutional to use the existing Espionage Act, not to charge espionage, although that word is often used, but to charge it under the Act to an official who has, it's a very, very broad, by the way, in the wording there as to who might be indicted, but none of them have recourse to what has been called a public interest defense or a defense of necessity, that this information, though held secret, and which actually you've promised usually the person to keep secret, must be known to the public, and that the reasons for doing that and the impact of doing that outweighs any government claim of its own privacy being in a democracy being infringed on and so forth. Now, that actually existed for a period under the British Official Secrets Act, and as a result that he could claim a public interest defense, that it was necessary for the public to know that the government had been lying and so forth. And Clive Ponting, without going into all the details here, showed very clearly that Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, had lied about the sinking of the, I think it was called the General Belgrano battleship during the Falklands War, the Malvinas War. And the judge virtually gave a directed verdict at the end of that trial to the jury, saying he's clearly violated the law here. And the jury contradicted that and acquitted him, as they were entitled to do. It's sometimes called jury nullification, but in this case, he had made a clear public interest defense, as he should have been able to do. Whereupon, of course, the Parliament quickly changed the law and removed that defense, essentially. So it's become like the American Espionage Act, which was never intended to deal with information leaks to the American people. It was for giving information, especially during war, to an enemy secretly. That's the way it had often been used and has since often been used. I was the first person to face that charge for giving information to the American public. You ask how that was done. Actually, it wasn't too difficult once I did it. When I made contact with Neil Sheehan of the New York Times, there's a backstory to this, but the bottom line is that he knew the significance of this right away. And a big question was whether they would publish documents that right up to the moment of publication was a matter of uncertainty in the New York Times. And I had given it on the assumption that promise actually that they would use documents. Almost no other paper did, by the way. The Washington Post did not print documents, and I'm not aware whether any of the others did right away, which seemed to be asking for prosecution a little more openly, even though it had never been done. But anyway, it wasn't at that time hard to get documents in. On the other hand, I'd been talking about Nixon's policy, which was based on what I'd been told by people like Morton Halpern, who was the aide to Henry Kissinger, my friend Jean-Paul Van in Vietnam, and I didn't have documents to show it. And no one believed me, even though I showed, this shows the limitations of whistleblowing, you might say, even though I was showing that four previous presidents, two of whom I'd worked for, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, I worked for three of them, had all lied in much the same way. People did not believe what I was telling them, that Nixon was doing the same kind of lying and would have the same kind of results of an ongoing war and a larger war. I didn't have the documents. And that's where Catherine, as I say, had a powerful impact there right away. So finally, I would have to say, yes, it is now more likely than before even that you will be identified. The risk is very high. And the personal consequences are likely to be very high, as they were for John, who hadn't broken the law, in fact. And in my case, I would say, had there been a public interest defense, it would have been, and there should be, and there could be, by legislative account. Various lawyers have called for pressing that. It doesn't exist now. What is new, of course, is Donald Trump using that law against the journalist for the first time, Julian Assange, and we'll probably come back to that. But up till now, it's been used only against sources, and I'm saying it should not be in the United States. Catherine, on the other hand, after Ponting, I guess, was facing a law that didn't allow her a defense, but she had a potential witness, Elizabeth Wilmshurst, who's prepared to say in court that in her legal opinion, the war was illegal. That was, I think without that, let me say, my guess is that she would have spent time in jail. I didn't, for almost miraculous reasons. What it comes down to is the personal risk is high. The fact that we found out it's not worth doing unless the lives to be saved, the consequences of not doing it, are so great that it is worth taking that risk. And there are such cases, many of them, including all three of us and many of others, to avert that war. Let me just give my own personal opinion. I think that Catherine, as I know her, would have gone to jail, absolutely, to avert that war. I won't speak for her, but that's my understanding of her. John Kiriakou did go to jail without even expecting it. Yes, I would have been gone to jail for life, as Julian is charged with 117 years possible. I was charged only with 115 years possible. But it comes to much the same thing. Was that worth doing? Of course that was worth doing. And that's why call these present circumstances where people are not doing, we have to have a change in attitude where people are challenged. What is right to keep those secrets?
Let me just put some of those points to John and to Catherine. And people are raising this on the questions as well about the pursuit of Julian Assange as a publisher or a journalist, rather than the pursuit of Chelsea Manning, of course, as the whistleblower. John, was there any moment where it looked as if people who'd run with your story were going to join you in the court case, or was that simply not in the frame at that time?
No, that never happened for me. We actively solicited support in the very beginning. Just after my arrest, one of my attorneys was assigned to be my liaison with the media. And so we had major outlets come to the lawyer's office for an off-the-record conversation. We had the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Politico. We had a bunch of them. And nobody wanted to touch it. It was an espionage case, and it was just too rough for them. A couple of them ended up being quasi-supportive, I suppose I could say, in public, but nobody really leapt to my defense. And I'd like to mention something, too, about how this affects Julian. I've been grossly disappointed in the behavior of the mainstream media surrounding Julian's case, because it's as though they can't appreciate or refuse to even try to appreciate the effect that this prosecution is going to have on them. It's so clear that Julian is a journalist, or even if you don't believe Julian's a journalist, that Julian is a publisher, that there's literally nothing to stop the FBI and whatever administration happens to be in power from going after the next publisher, be it at the Washington Post or the Times or whatever outlet publishes something that the administration doesn't like. So if you can have a publisher facing 115 years in prison, which, let's be honest, is really a death sentence, then it can happen to literally anybody. I tried saying this in my own case, that if they can go after me and lock me up, well, they can do it to anybody who crosses them. There's a terrific book called Three Felonies a Day, written by Harvey Silverglate, a professor of law at Harvard University. And he argues that we're so over-criminalized, so over-regulated and politicized in this country that the average person on the average day going about his or her normal business commits three felonies every day, with the idea being, if they don't like you, if they don't like your politics, they can go after you and there's virtually nothing you can do to protect yourself. Well, that's what they've done to Julian. He was a disruptor and they don't like his politics. And so they decide to attack him and to ruin him. Well, who's going to protect him? That falls on the rest of us to try to protect him, because we have to draw that line somewhere. If we don't draw the line, if we don't try to protect one another, if we don't try to protect a journalist or a publisher, then we don't live in a democracy and there won't be anybody to protect us.
Mm. John, very good points. And just the moment where I should say, by the way, if you want to join in campaigning to stop Julian being extradited to the United States, or indeed stop him being kept in prison during an epidemic, then please do visit the Don't Extradite Assange campaign website, where there is a petition and a lobby tool where you can write to MPs. Please do share those. Please do sign those. And please do look out for future actions and events like this. Julian said it many times. John's just said it. It is really only a mobilized, aware and active population that's going to be the last line of defense. And certainly the only thing that can bring effective pressure on the court system and the politicians, and indeed on journalists, and help journalists to defend themselves. Catherine, on that question, the film about what you did gives us an insight into what the battles were inside the Observer between Martin Bright and Ed Vulliamy and the editors that eventually got the story that Yvonne Ridley brought to them, your story, out there. I'm interested to know if you were aware that those battles were going on in that way at the time. Was that apparent to you? You obviously very narrowly escaped going to jail. Were you surprised at the way in which the court system dealt with you?
Well, I had absolutely no idea what was going on at the Observer at the time, of course, because I didn't even know it had gone to the Observer. I mean, you know, so actually seeing those scenes when the first time I watched the film, it was sort of astonishing to me, you know, because obviously after the whole event had, you know, when they dropped the case against me, and I did talk to Martin Bright, but even so, even talking to him and so on, you know, you don't talk about those sorts of things necessarily. So, yeah, I really enjoyed watching those scenes. And Martin Bright was actually there the whole time on set, actually had a cameo, as did his wife, and in the film. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people have said it was a very good sort of portrayal of a newsroom, that one of the most accurate portrayals they've seen in film. And sorry, what was the second point?
About whether you were surprised about the way in which the court system behaved when you were going through that.
Well, yeah, the whole case was just bizarre. I mean, first of all, I'd confessed, right? I'd confessed that I'd made the leak. But they didn't charge me straight away. So I was bailed. I was bailed for 8 months. At which point, you know, it was almost quite a shock when they decided to charge me, because we'd come to the conclusion that if they were going to charge me, they would have done it by now. You know, why drag it out for 8 months? Mm. Then when they did go ahead and charge me, that, you know, as I say, that was quite a shock. But when we started calling for all the legal advice that the government had prior to the invasion, you know, the full set of legal advice, and we had got wind that, as Dan had said about Elizabeth Wilmhurst possibly being called as a witness and so on, it was just amazing how quickly the prosecution turned around and dropped the case. So the fact that, you know, within about a week or even less, when this call from the defense team to come forward with documents came out, they dropped the case. And to this day, we don't have a real, I think, sufficiently accurate reason, factual reason for why they did drop the case. Mm. It's deemed the whole reason behind why the case was dropped and all of that, why I was charged, why it was dropped, is all now apparently national security information, so they can't disclose any more about it.
Mm. So would you say it's often Gareth Pearce, Julian's lawyer, often makes the case that or puts the argument that half of what happens in a court case is what happens in the courtroom. The other half, and this decides often whether or not these things are won or lost, is the politics that surrounds it, which in a way is a kind of, it's a hopeful message for activists because you can affect the political environment of a case. Do you feel that was borne out by your experience?
Well, I have to, you know, I think, to be fair, in the UK, at the time of my case, there wasn't a lot of negative press. I mean, John talks about the politicization of his case. I think on the whole, because the Iraq war was so deeply unpopular and so many, and by the time the case was coming up for trial at the end of 2003, beginning of 2004, I think, you know, it was becoming more and more apparent that the whole invasion was a fiasco. It was a disaster. And so I you know, apart from one or two maybe slightly snarky articles in the usual types of, conservative press, there wasn't a lot of, it was mostly extremely positive reporting, pretty much in my favor. And I think that probably would have continued. I would hope it would have continued if it had gone on to a full trial.
Mm. John, let me just come back to you because there's a whole bunch of people asking the same question, which is, if Julian is extradited to the United States, can he face a fair trial? And, you know, you've been on both sides of the fence here. So your answer to that question is probably better than most.
Let me answer that question by telling a short story. I hired O.J. Simpson's jury consultant in my case. He has never lost a case. He represented O.J. Simpson and William Kennedy Smith and George Zimmerman in the Trayvon Martin case. He's a winner. And we got him a security clearance. He came to Washington and he reviewed all the documents. And at the end of it, he said to me, if we were in any other district in America besides the Eastern District of Virginia, I would say, let's go for it. We're going to win. But the Eastern District of Virginia, he said, your jury would be made up of people from the CIA, the FBI, the Pentagon, the Department of Homeland Security, and intelligence community contractors or their family members. He said, you don't stand a chance in the Eastern District of Virginia. That's why they charged you there. I fear the same thing for Julian, that they charged him in the Eastern District of Virginia because it's called the espionage court, because no national security defendant has ever won a case there. And that's why I think that our best shot for Julian in the Eastern District is through publicity and the possibility of jury nullification. We have to get the word out that the man is a journalist, and you can't prosecute journalists for telling the truth. It really is an issue as simple as that. So I think that our real work hasn't yet begun, at least not on this side of the Atlantic. Absolutely, we need to be fighting extradition in the UK. And I think he, I'm not an attorney, but I really believe he has a shot in the UK. If he loses that fight for extradition, then it's incumbent on the rest of us here in the United States to constantly talk about this case, to constantly hit home that the man is a journalist, and that this is going to open up a Pandora's box that just we will not be able to close. And so if we can't fight the case in the courtroom, by all means, we have to fight it outside the courtroom. I think that's where we win it.
Okay, John, thank you very much for that. Now, we're coming up on the hour, so I'm going to make this the last question of the evening to Daniel Ellsberg. And it's one that's cropping up in the comments all the time now, which is, and you touched on it, in the era of coronavirus, how important do you think it is that whistleblowers and organizations like WikiLeaks exist? And I have to say, just having experienced this, as the rest of us have in the past couple of months here in Britain, it's a remarkable thing. And I've said this publicly. I can remember no other time except the refusal by the American state to issue fatalities in the Iraq war, when a modern government has refused to tell its own people how many of them are dying. The statistics are now reckoned to be twice those that the British government is issuing on a daily basis. There have been a huge number of deaths in old people's homes that have been, well, if not covered up, certainly suppressed. So we're in the middle of an information crisis. You know, how can governments plan? How can we know what's happening if we don't have that information? And we're living through a moment where it's not clear that the government is even willing to address the most fundamental statistic that there is, how many people have died. So with that in mind, Daniel, WikiLeaks, that kind of organization, the work that all three of you have been involved in about telling the truth, government transparency, more important than ever?
We have an unprecedented situation now, I think, where some two-thirds of the country knows that the president lies every time he opens his mouth. It's no longer a secret. It's no longer something we discover later with somebody like Nixon or someone. They know it right now. 13,000 lies, I think the Washington Post has added up so far. And a third of the country, his base, either doesn't believe that, whatever happens, or doesn't care, whatever happens. And we're in an extraordinary situation where it is at least a very sizable possibility that this man will be reelected. That's a terrible statement to make about the United States of America, my country. Not that we invite the electoral system with our electoral college and all permitted him to join the share of the White House initially, but a second time. I have studied catastrophes for a long time, the possibility of nuclear war, the possibility of an expanded or continued Vietnam War, and that led me to study catastrophes in general. And what I've discovered is that in every case I've looked at, and there must be counterexamples, but I've never found one, there were before the event authoritative voices saying that this was not only possible, but in many cases likely to happen under the actual course of events, despite the later, after they occurred, account in every case, no one could have foreseen this, no one predicted it to me, no one warned it. No, it's always false. So the question then arises, how could it be that the public remained unaware of this? And it's not only government situations, it's also corporate in many cases. The lack of whistleblowers, in other words, virtually every catastrophe, every major failure that comes along, it would be useful to ask the question, who knew about this was coming and what did they do about it? And that's, as I said earlier, that's of course true right here in COVID-19. It's not only how many of it died, but how many are predicted to die by authoritative people, and that includes people in the government, even when the president is lying. And what are they going to do about it besides telling a president or his services something that the president has heard from other people as well and is going to ignore and lie about, said, I never heard this, and no indication of this, whatever. There really has to be a new ethic here, I would say. And there has to be, obviously, a place for those people to go. And it's not, it's both a question of whether they'll be identified. Probably they will be eventually. Actually, we need more people who are willing to be identified. Catherine disclosed herself. So did Snowden. Chelsea Manning told me she was going to do it eventually, especially if someone else was charged. So did I, because none of us wanted someone else to be charged in our place and weren't willing to do that. So we did identify ourselves. We took those risks. Was that wrong? Was that martyrdom? Was that crazy? No. The risks involved certainly made that, speaking for myself, in most whistleblowers, the obviously right thing to do, the normal thing, ordinary, didn't think of themselves as being extraordinary at that time. I don't know one who thought, ah, I'm the person. What they did think, as Snowden has put it, as Chelsea has put it, this needs to be out. No one else is going to put it out. So I'll do it. And that third point, which characterizes us all, obviously Catherine here, and John, although he thought it was out already, but he thought, all right, this needs to be out. And that third point of, so I'll do it, is the one that people don't cross. And we need to change that ethic, and we have to have channels like WikiLeaks for it to get out when the others refuse. Remember that Chelsea Manning approached both the Times and the Washington Post and returned away before she went to WikiLeaks. There's other cases like that. I could mention the media break-in of the FBI where they tried to tell the LA Times and the Washington Post, but couldn't get it out. They got it out finally somewhere, but returned away. WikiLeaks is the place of last resort, and I say last only because the others get more attention if you get the documents out. But when they turn it down or they delay, then you need a WikiLeaks. And so I really, as John has put it very well, I won't repeat it, I just totally agree with what he says. Journalists must recognize that their own, the future of a free press in this country depends on these charges not leading to the conviction of Julian Assange. And I have to say, I differ with John maybe just a little, not in hopes, but in prospects. I think if he gets over here, even in not in the Eastern District, I don't think he gets away. With the way the law is being administered now, he would have had a chance with a different Supreme Court, as in my day, who would say this is an unconstitutional violation of the First Amendment, this use of the Espionage Act. You can't count on that at all. It's not even likely with the current Supreme Court. This court would not have avoided the injunction at that point, the way they did 6-3, it would be at least 5-4 in the other direction. So from a longer term point of view, the law must be changed through Congress to allow a recognition that in some cases the public needs to know, must know, and that overrides the government decisions of secrecy. And for Julian, I really think no extradition. I think if the extradition is here, free press in this country of national security matters has gone down the drain.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Daniel Ellsberg, John Kiriakou, and Catherine Gunn. It was a real pleasure to host you here. And if the audience looking in, hundreds and hundreds of people looking in, actually, if they found it half as fascinating as I did, they will have found it very fascinating indeed. And I guess there's one conclusion that I'd like to draw out at the end of this. I was organising the anti-war movement in Britain at the time that Catherine Gunn was being dragged through that. And I knew Yvonne Ridley. We worked with Yvonne Ridley. I had no idea until I saw the film that it was Yvonne Ridley who'd taken your story to the Observer. And the conclusion I draw from that, the lesson of that, I think, is this. Don't ever think that what you're doing doesn't matter. How small it is, sharing this video, signing a petition, going on a protest, don't ever think that it isn't worthwhile doing, because you never know who else is out there acting in the same way, who else will draw sustenance from the things that you do, and who you'll find and begin to coalesce with and organise with and become a collectivity down the line. We're doing what we can here to make sure that Julian Assange never arrives in the United States or in the Eastern District Court. So if you haven't supported us, please do go to the DEA Twitter feed or to the Don't Extradite Assange Facebook page or to our website and give us a hand. We're much stronger if we act together. But for now, thanks very much for watching. And again, my thanks to Catherine Gunn, John Kiriakou, Daniel Ellsberg, an extraordinary panel of people. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your bravery. And thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, John.
Yeah, thank you.